Living in New York, I've come to think that anything is possible. But I still find it incredible that there are some 100,000 active, self-identified witches in America today. And this says nothing of the numbers who sympathize. Who are these people? What makes them hold seemingly irrational beliefs in our modern society? Tanya Lerman, otherwise known as TM, spent 14 months in London meeting with pagans nearly every evening. What she found is collected in the astonishing new book from Harvard University Press called Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, Ritual Magic in Contemporary England. And joining her today on Ear Can Company is Margot Adler, whose voice will be familiar to National Public Radio listeners. Margot is also a witch. I'm pleased to welcome both of you to New York and Company. Hi.
Good to be here.
100,000 is a lot of witches in this country. Does that indicate a revival of witchcraft?
Well, I never thought that witchcraft existed.
Talking to you, Mike.
Yeah. Right. I don't think that witchcraft actually existed before 1945 or thereabouts. I mean, in many societies throughout cultures, throughout history, there have been fantasies that other people possess malevolent power to cause illness, to attack the fertility of crops and animals. And when misfortune occurs to somebody, in some societies, people will attribute that misfortune to witchcraft. That doesn't mean that there were any actual witches, or at least not groups of witches practicing in covens and following a coherent religion. I think that that sort of witchcraft developed only in the sort of mid-20th century. Now, it's certainly true that since the 40s, witchcraft has become much more popular, and particularly in this country, I think it has increasing appeal because of a feminist political angle that reaches out to women, and that many women would describe as providing them with a feminist spirituality, a spirituality suited for women.
You know, this comes as a bit of a surprise to me because the story, as I've heard it again and again, is that this is a traditional method of dealing with medicine, healing, and whatever else that goes back to pre-Christian times, and the new witches are simply carrying on that tradition, handed down from mother to daughter.
Not true.
And you're saying 1945.
Well, wait. This is, first of all, let's take up this 100,000 figure. And I'm not sure there are 100,000 self-identified witches in the United States. What that figure is saying is there are probably about that many people who identify themselves in the United States with either goddess spirituality, neo-paganism in many, many forms, and modern-day witchcraft. There are probably also maybe even more people who call themselves witches for entirely different reasons, because they're tarot readers or they're, astrologers or whatever. And what we're talking about here—
And you as a witch would not really— That's not a witch.
I'm talking about witchcraft as a religion, basically. Mm-hmm. That's the difference I'm talking about. Now, what we're really saying is that there certainly are continuations of older pagan religions. And a lot of people who are into the Wiccan religion will call themselves the old religion, basically. Mm-hmm. They're talking about revivals and recreations of pagan traditions. And there certainly are pagan legacies that we have, and myths and great traditions, and the Greeks, the Romans, the Celts, all that stuff. But I would say that the modern witchcraft religion owes an enormous amount to what happened with the sort of intermeshing of the folklore movement, Gerald Gardner in England starting in the late 30s and 40s, and sort of a revival and recreation, perhaps a new form that has really nothing to do with witchcraft as it was talked about by the Inquisitors or witchcraft in any form that most people think about.
We can almost see it in popular culture. There were hardly any films about witchcraft before 1945 or so, and now virtually no month goes by without some variation on Rosemary's Baby or the like, in which witches are painted as being involved in the worst forms of Satanism and all sorts of other terrible, dark, magical things.
Sure, but I think that stems from a different impulse in the culture. I mean, I don't understand why there's so much enthusiasm for Satanism and sort of sex-crazed,
because Geraldo Rivero needs to keep on making shows.
Right.
And
also,
these people.
Yeah, and also I think those films, actually I think there were more of them in some sense a few years ago, except you do have, like, Friday the 13th part
95.
Right?
Yeah. No. But these are people who are reaching out to so-called traditional symbols, symbols from different cultures, different sort of historical periods, weaving them together using techniques that have been common to religions throughout the world, techniques of meditation, visualization, seeing mental images. And those are, in some sense, traditional techniques because they've been around for a while.
But this is
but
a new religion.
But as Margaret said, this is a new religion.
Now, who was attracted to this new religion? I read a statistic that says that 2 or 3 out of every 10 British witches comes from Catholic or Pentecostal homes. Of course, that means that seven or so come from other kinds of Protestant homes. But what does that mean?
Well, okay, that's not a strict figure. I mean, that was my personal impression of the sort of people who tended to get involved. But basically, my impression, at least in Britain, is slightly different in America. In Britain, the people who get involved are middle class. They're reasonably successful in their jobs. They're so-called normal people. You can't pick out who is a witch and, or a magician or a cabalist at a party from anybody else. They tend to have common temperamental traits, I notice. But again, this is not a set of temperamental characteristics unique to this practice. It's shared by a lot of people. And these traits are things like being imaginative, being reasonably intellectual. This is a world of books. People come into this practicing world because they pick up a book on witchcraft or the Celtic religion in the occult bookstore. They read 10 books and they start to look for sort of signs or notices in the occult bookstore. You know, Linda's forming a coven, applicants free to apply. I mean,
it's true. It's exactly how it happens, right? Wicca study group or something, right? Mondays at the Brooklyn Unitarian Church. Right?
Tanya, you say that in England, many of them are involved in the computer industry. Well, computer industry is even newer than this wicked religion.
Absolutely. And the computer industry is, again, something I don't fully understand. I mean, it is a fact that the computer industry is full of people who are into Dungeons and Dragons. They're into sort of science fiction, which is now becoming a magical, fantastical science fiction. They're Tolkien readers. And it's that same sort of current that draws them into
what
magic.
What do they work at? Weird processors?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Actually, in the United States, we did a survey a number of years ago, and we figured out that something like 16% of the people who got involved in paganism, goddess spirituality, witchcraft, were involved in some form of computer-related work. They were either systems engineers. Oh, absolutely. And we actually asked a question of these people, why is that true? And they came back with extraordinarily wonderful answers, among them things like that, like magic, you this is more like ceremonial magic, not like Wicca religion. They say, you know, you sort of tame a unruly beast using odd languages and words and make it do your bidding.
A
but
lot
it has.
Of jargon.
I think that that's I mean, I think there's
magical
an aspect
words.
Of truth in that.
Magical
I think
words.
That's, I mean, these are people in both magic and computer sciences who are using rules and symbols to create a little world. Well, sometimes a big world, but a world that one can create and control. And I think many of the metaphors in the science fiction are metaphors of computer programmers as wizards, people who have the power to create and control worlds.
In fact, an awful lot of people involved in computers use wizard kinds of names for themselves, especially
absolutely.
The hackers who see this as a semi-magical act.
So, et cetera, as a kind of craft.
Neither of you are involved in the computer business.
Well, I'm actually married to one. We have 8 computers in our home, so it's actually true.
Yes. 8 computers?
Well, some of them are laptops and some of them are old ones decaying away, but yeah, right.
Dinosaur computers, I think they're called.
Yeah.
But you see that connection yourself?
Well, I'm not involved. I just use it for writing and word processing and so forth. But I do think that
awful lot of non-witchers use them that way,
I
too.
I think that people who are attracted... Here are the reasons that I think people are attracted to Wicca and neo-paganism. I think, number one, they really appeal to the imagination. And they are also do-it-yourself religions, which is very American. You know, it's sort of religion without the middle person. You create it yourself. You do your rituals yourself. You don't need a priest. You don't need a rabbi. You just go there. You get a group of friends together, and you do it yourself. So it's very American in that sense. It also appeals, I think, to the frustrated ritualist priest minister in ourselves. I mean, you'll find an enormous number of women who, for example, might have gone into the ministry if their own religions had allowed them to do this, ex-Catholics who perhaps would have become priests if they had been allowed to, and suddenly they're adopting women's spirituality and goddess spirituality because it gives them a forum to do religious work in a way that's meaningful to them. There are a lot of other reasons.
But before we go on any further, I want to define terms for a moment because a lot of different words get used here, and I don't know whether to use them interchangeably or not, which words I should use, which I shouldn't. We've been using the word witch. We've been using pagans, neo-pagan, Wicca. We haven't said warlock yet, but I know that, Tanya, you don't use that word in your book.
Right. And, people
and
tend
you're
not
shaking.
To call themselves warlocks.
They're just male witches.
Male and female tend to call
everybody's
themselves
a witch.
Witches,
Or a pagan.
And the story, I don't know if this is true. Is this true, Tanya? What I heard is that the name warlock was actually coined by Sir Walter Scott in a book, and that it sort of comes from Loki, Loki the god of lies, so no one wants to be called that.
I think that's actually true.
Is that true? I've heard that.
I'm not confident of whether it's true, but I know it's a late, the word has a relatively late origin.
Well, you want to take
some
definitions?
So does the whole religion, it seems.
Okay. Which ones do you want? Let's divide them
now
up.
Now, can I say pagan and witch interchangeably?
No.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'll start with witch. Okay, a witch, and there are many different people who call themselves witches for sort of the reasons that Marco explained.
Mm-hmm.
But
so it can
this...
get confusing because you could call yourself a witch and somebody else, and you have nothing in common with each other.
Yeah, and the first person that I met involved in witchcraft called herself a witch, but was a member of no organization, had met some members of organizations. But, I mean, she was sort of sui generis. I mean, she really was
But would you have called
individual.
Her a witch now that you know?
I mean, I rely on people's self-definition, basically. But the people that I thought were interesting and the people who I paid attention to were people who, first of all, there's magic. Magic has many different definitions, many different understandings. Roughly, I think that people think of magic, or the people who practice magic think of it as referring to forces in the world that may or may not be recognized by science. These forces connect the different elements in the world, and you can alter the relations of those forces by using your imagination and by using the non-rational part of your mind.
Okay, but how does that differ from parapsychology and other New Age ways of looking at science and related matters?
Not a lot. The difference is that the people who use the word magic are usually trying to change those forces, while the people who use the word parapsychology are trying to experiment to see if those forces exist. I mean, this is the world of fuzzy definition and loose references. But the people who call themselves witches are like people who call themselves Kabbalists or members of the Western Mysteries or followers of the sort of Egyptian Mysteries, people who join in themselves into groups, and the groups see themselves in a sort of spiritual tradition descending from early mystery religions, the Eleusinian Mysteries, the Orphic Mysteries, the Mithraic Mysteries, using many of the same techniques and much of the same symbolism. The witches describe themselves as pagans who are following a pre-Christian fertility religion. They join themselves into groups called covens, which are organized by a high priestess and a high priest in some traditions. And the symbols they use are symbols drawn from sort of agrarian mythology, the stuff that comes out of James Frazer and the Golden Bough. And then they meet on the Sabbath. So they meet on the pagan, sort of the early pagan festivals, Halloween, Candlemas, Lammas, Beltane, May 1st. And they also meet on the full moons where they perform spells.
So last night was an important night because it was a full moon.
Yes, well, I must say that they tend to meet on the Saturday night closest to the full moon.
this is the modern world, right? Sometimes some groups meet on the full moon. I would say that the witches, modern witches who are using this definition in a religious sense, are generally coming out of what I would call a Northern European form of paganism, or certainly a Western European form of paganism. But there are people who are pagan, basically, you know, it comes from a word meaning country dweller, and basically it can be almost any polytheistic, animistic, pantheistic, nature religion. It can be anything from, you know, Egyptian, Greek, and Roman ancient religions to Native American to Australian Aboriginal. Pagan can take in an enormous breadth of, you know, anything that's not a religion of the book. You know, anything that's not coming out of the Jewish, Christian, Islamic tradition can be pagan. I mean, Shintoism is paganism at some level. Neo-pagans are basically, it's a word that's been used in the United States a lot to sort of look at all the people who are mostly white Westerners who are trying to recreate in a new form, redefine in a new form, a pagan religion that, just like the Society for Creative Anachronism, recreates the Middle Ages not as it was, but as they'd like it to be, a paganism that we might enjoy for this time.
Knowing what I know about how these things work, we are soon to see post-paganism and then post-post-paganism. My guests are Margot Adler, who's a journalist, a correspondent for National Public Radio on both Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and T.M. Lerman, who is a research fellow at Christ's College in Cambridge, England, and she has written a book about witchcraft in England called Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, Ritual Magic in Contemporary England. It's published by Harvard University Press. We will be back with more of our conversation. I want to find out what witches actually do after this. My guests on New York & Company are T.M. Lerman, whose book is called Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, Ritual Magic in Contemporary England. It's published by Harvard University Press. And Margot Adler, who is a reporter for NPR and a journalist and also a practicing, what can we say, a member of the...
I'm not a member of any group. I'm a neo-pagan who has been involved in Wicca for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Tanya, are you also... you never really reveal that here in this book.
Right.
You just seem to be deeply interested.
Yeah, I mean, the anthropologist is supposed to go native and then come back and tell it like it was. And that's roughly what I did. I mean, I got involved in a bunch of different groups. I got involved in a witch's coven and a sort of a Western Mysteries group and a group of people who just pulled themselves together into a ritual magic group and a bunch of other things. I did probably over 100 rituals.
Mm-hmm.
But now I don't think of myself as a witch or a magician, although I've certainly learned a lot from the practice and gained from it.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't tempted to make the next step?
Well, it
you
would be professionally quite dangerous.
Oh.
It is professionally dangerous.
I'm sure. I'm sure that this is a problem, that no matter how respectable you are in your life, if you say to somebody, I am a neo-pagan, immediately those people look at you with a funny glance, don't they? Don't they immediately assume all sorts of things that you would prefer that they not assume, Margot?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say, speaking quite frankly, that my career ladder would have been slightly different, and I won't go further than that, if I had not been public about these ideas.
Mm-hmm. Because there are many people who are not public about these things, as we've seen from all those movies, and they are really controlling the forces of the universe secretly.
No.
As an American, Tanya, why did you look into witchcraft in England?
I ended up in England for graduate school, I think for a variety of different reasons. And
take your hands off of that microphone.
Right. Okay.
Oops, I see what happened. I see what's happening. Okay, continue talking and we'll hope for the best.
Okay, and I decided to study witchcraft and magic because I'd always been interested in imagination and belief, and anthropologists are supposed to explain the extraordinary beliefs that other people have, and they usually explain them by looking at beliefs in different cultures, and the fact that it's a different culture is somehow relevant to the sorts of explanations that they give. And I had come across a book written by a woman called Starhawk on how to be a witch just before I started my graduate career. And this book told you how to draw a magical circle on the ground, how to perform a spell, what sort of things witches thought were important. I mean, and it seemed to me that if people were reading this book and taking it seriously, I could learn a lot about belief and imagination and how people came to assert views ideas that other people took to be foolish. And I was thinking initially of doing this work in America, but I was in Britain, and I ran into a friend of a friend's friend who said that she was a witch, and she introduced me to somebody else. And then it turned out that there was this active subculture which was quite intriguing and very interesting.
Margaret,
so I ended up staying there.
You've read the book, and do you feel that this book just could have easily been written in the United States? Are there real differences because the British do see themselves as going back to Druidian times?
Well, I think this is a very different book than the book I wrote about witchcraft in the United States. It is a very different book. It's a beautifully written book, for one thing. But I'm not saying that mine wasn't either, but it is a beautifully written book. But I think it's very clear from reading the book that there are a lot of differences between the stuff that's going on in England and the stuff that's going on in the United States. From what I read, and Tanya can certainly say if I'm wrong or right, it's clear that the witches and magicians in England are a little more secretive, I think, than the ones in the United States in general. That she also focused a lot more than books have in the United States on magical groups that are not specifically witchcraft. So she focused on Christian ritual groups, that went from a lot of, you know, on a lot of different facets like that. Also, I think another thing which I know from having talked to Tanya, and she can tell you more about it herself, the feminist movement isn't really going on in a big way in England in the same way. I mean, in the United States, partly because of Starhawk's books and partly because of just feminist spirituality in general, easily half or maybe more than half of what's going on in regard to Wicca and goddess is women who have come to suddenly look at the feminine divine and see what that is and see how important
that is. A rejection of patriarchal religions.
You got it. And I think that's not as defined in England, or that's not happening in England, right?
Yeah, that's not as relevant. I mean, of the different witchcraft groups I encountered, I mean, of, say, five or six of them, goddess worship was important to all of them, but only one of those groups defined themselves as a women's mystery, or two of those groups defined themselves as women's mysteries groups. Mm-hmm. And people in general didn't talk as politically about their religious interests. There's another interesting difference, which is that the British, because they value privacy so much, tend to think that psychology isn't quite legitimate. And so if they, when the British explain why magical spells work, they're more likely to tell you in great detail about these parapsychological forces, whereas Americans are more likely to say, well, the spells work, but you know, regardless of whether they work, they're psychologically potent.
Mm-hmm. My guests on New York & Company are T.M. Lerman, author of Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, Ritual Magic in Contemporary England, and Margot Adler of NPR. This is WNYC, AM 83, New York Public Radio. Can you learn how to cast spells and do all the other stuff that witches do from a how-to book?
Sure, to some extent. I mean, the books tell you magic is a world of the imagination. It's about using symbols, images in a powerful and personally effective way to allow you to, in theory, use your imagination to concentrate upon a particular image and sort of direct it or direct the magical energy with your willpower towards a particular goal. Well, you can learn the techniques of concentration, meditation, and visualization from a how-to book. Like most how-to books, it's more easily done in the techniques are more easily learned in company with other people.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing we could say is that these are techniques that are partially the property of every religion. Mm-hmm. And the example that I would give is, let's say, you're in a crisis. Suddenly, you know, there's a truck and your little 3-year-old kid is about, you know, has the car is like, you know, and suddenly the mother rushes up and with even superhuman strength somehow lifts the car. I mean, you hear about things like that.
I call it adrenaline lift.
Yes, exactly. Right. Well, that happens when we are in certain crises. People have near-death experiences where strange things happen, etc. I personally believe that a lot of what happens in magical ritual is it's a series of techniques to sort of get to that place at will, as opposed to when just life sort of hits you over the head with it. So these are techniques like meditation, getting yourself in an altered state of consciousness, awakening the artistic, the dream parts of ourselves.
But, you know, there are a lot of magical religions that are not European-oriented. Mm-hmm. For example, Santeria, which has both male and female priests, santeros and santeras, the Haitian voodoo religions, and a whole bunch of other things. Are they all pretty much the same thing, only with a different underlying philosophy?
Oh, boy.
Yes and no. I mean...
You must be a lawyer. Yes and no. That's what you're saying.
Look, I think that they have certain similarities in that they're polytheistic. Mm-hmm. They basically are based mostly on experience and not on a set of words and creeds and laws in a Bible or a Quran or something like that.
They don't have a dogma.
Basically, they're much more experiential. They're based on, you know, you do stuff for the crops, you do stuff to, you know, get rites of passage. So in that way, they're similar. What's happening, I think, that's very important to emphasize here is that most of the people in the neo-pagan movement are, well, they're whites, most of them. I'm not saying they're all whites, but a lot of them are whites. And they don't have vibrant, rich traditions that are right around them. They don't have Santeria. They don't have something. So they're going back and saying, well, what in my own tradition, where are the songs, the stories, the myths, the how can I have an earth religion just like the Native Americans? I can't be a Native American.
Or an African American might very well say, what is my African roots
exactly. Provide
me with in this area?
Absolutely.
And then find
and
some
go
Nigerian
back.
Religion.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So in this case, but in Britain, people actually can cite real connections a lot more because religions like this were practiced all the way into the Christian era.
Absolutely. And I mean, people see that continuity strongly. Whether how actual the continuity is not actually clear. And witches and magical practitioners themselves are ambivalent about the facticity of describing our religion in the burning times.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, they're willing to say that maybe, in fact, there weren't witches in their terms back in the 16th and 17th centuries.
And we could do that pre-war Wicca and post-war Wicca, in a way.
The interesting thing is that many people in Britain feel very powerfully about the land. And this means that the Native American mm-hmm. tradition, which is so powerful here, is not so strong in Britain. I mean, there people will go to the stone circles, which have been there since the dawn of time, and they'll talk about the power in the ground. They'll talk about their sense of being inside a circle that's very, very ancient. I think that connection of the land is also very powerful here, but the symbolism is different.
And the symbolism relates to Hopis and other Indian traditions that practice some form of magic here?
Well, I think there are certainly Americans who are sort of adopting sort of Native American stuff, but that's a whole other thing. I mean, the whole point in some ways of the revival of Wicca is that you don't have to do that, that you can figure mm-hmm. out a tradition that's closer perhaps to your own European roots mm-hmm. and that you're not doing, which I think is somewhat, there's a problem of adopting someone else's culture when, number one, you don't know anything about it and you're basically ripping them off.
But could you wind up with a Catholic form of Wicca or a Jewish form of Wicca or
absolutely.
And you have them.
Pentecostal?
You have them.
These are people who are incredibly syncretic. I mean, again, the theory is that you're using imagination and you're using images which speak to you. That means that the particular images you choose are more or less irrelevant. They're the ones that are significant and meaningful. And so you can end up with people using a Celtic invocation to an Egyptian goddess in a Kabbalistic ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that anything goes as long as it makes you feel as if you're magically powerful.
Well, let's put it further. Let's go a little further. As long as it works. So does it work? In the end, and what can you make happen and what can't you make happen?
Well, I decided to be agnostic on this issue. I mean, I'm interested in how people interpret events mm-hmm. and why they come to interpret events.
But you must have a lot of anecdotal information.
Sure, but in a sense, I lived on two worlds when I was doing this field work. I lived on two levels. So that on the one hand, I was getting involved in the rituals. I was going to ceremonies. I was doing magic. I began to feel magical power. I began to participate in rituals and look for the impact of the ritual to see if it had worked, to see if we'd cured the back problem, or, you know, to see if there had been some...
And you had some weird experiences.
And I had some weird experiences. And they were very impressive for me.
Mm-hmm.
When I had those experiences, I also, on the other level of my mind, I also ticked those off to say, gee, this is one of the significant experiences that helps people make sense of this type of practice and makes it significant and meaningful.
I know somebody else who had an experience like that, flirted with witchcraft for a time, said that she really felt that she had achieved the things that she'd wanted to, and then abandoned it because it just seemed like it was going to take a too much of her time, too much of her energy, and it was also certain there were certain forces there that she was frightened by, and now she's moved in such an opposite direction that you would think that that had never been a part of her life. So you can actually compartmentalize this in some way. I mean, most religions become integrated in everything that people do.
Well, I think so does Wicca. I mean, most people who live a life of within the Wiccan religion think of it as a total mm-hmm. life, mm-hmm. a way of living that encompasses everything. On the other hand, I mean, people are ornery, crazy, interesting, odd beings. And people's response to something like magic is going to be completely different depending on who they are. I mean, I have a tendency personally to be very psychological about everything. So when I answered the question that you asked, Tanya Lerman, I would say that in my experiences, those rituals that have had to do with personal empowerment have been incredibly successful for me. In other words, sitting down, 30 minutes and sort of programming myself before going into a job interview to not be Margot Adler with all her self-doubts and really messed up, but in some way to be the goddess incarnate. And, I'll walk into that job interview and, blow them away. Now, what was that? That was a set of psychological techniques, positive mm-hmm. thinking, all that kind of stuff.
Bernie Siegel would say
exactly.
That has nothing to do with witchcraft. It has to do with visualizing.
Well, but we would say that is exactly what we're talking about. You see, we would say that we're not talking about something supernatural, that we're talking about something very natural, essentially, that these are natural abilities that we don't always use, that great artists sometimes use, that we use when we dream, that we don't use in our day-to-day life all the time.
Well, if that's the case, then why are we talking about something that in which dark-handled knives are required, whips are used to purify, goddesses have robes but generally perform in the nude? I mean, that goes way beyond job interview techniques.
Okay, sure. I think that many people have make stronger claims about the power and magical efficacy of their rituals, and many people would talk about sort of force in the world. The thing that's interesting is the variety of explanations that you get which people will produce to make sense of forces or activities or practices that seem so different from the everyday. It's certainly true that people integrate their religious practice into their ordinary sense of themselves, and that's true for magicians in the same way that it's true for Christians. At the same time, religion is also something that's unto itself. One of the jobs that the magical ritual does is to make magic a separate and different world. People put on different clothes, or they take off their clothes, they use different names, they perform rituals in a particular space. They use all this sort of theatrical paraphernalia to make the ritual world separate. And the way in which they then make sense of the separate ritual world and their ordinary world will vary. People will tell you that it's the same world. What's true in science is true in magic, and the two are the same. Other people will tell you that, they're two different worlds. They practice magic and they believe in magic. They go to their computer programming job and they don't believe in magic. Other people will tell you that all truth is relative, and they know that you don't believe them, but what's true for them is true mm-hmm. for them, and that's all that matters. There's no objective touchstone. Other people will even tell you that they believe in magic, they believe in witchcraft, but they believe that their belief is false. Nevertheless, they believe it because it's good for them, because it's psychologically beneficial. And sometimes the same person will give you all those different arguments. So, I mean, the interesting thing is how people negotiate what their involvement with something that's seen by other people as so separate.
Well, we have to take a little break here. When we come back, I want to get back to the psychological thing, because psychology is also used as an explanation for the effect. For example, the simple one of putting a pin in a voodoo doll and the person feeling the pain, it's generally explained as being two people believing in the same system, so it works. Right. My guests are T.M. Lerman, who's an anthropologist, research fellow at Christ College in Cambridge, England, and author of Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, Ritual Magic in Contemporary England. It's published by Harvard University Press. And Margot Adler, who is a journalist, the NPR correspondent who's heard so often on this station, and also a witch. We're talking about contemporary witchcraft with T.M. Lehrman, author of Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, published by Harvard University Press, and Margot Adler, who is a journalist and a witch. T.M., you say in your book that homosexuals cannot perform witchcraft?
Only in certain groups. There are certain groups of magical practitioners, particularly in England, people who call themselves Kabbalists and involved with the Western mysteries. And they tend, this goes back to an earlier point that Margaret was talking about, but these people tend to be very politically conservative. And they have an idea that's...
Politically conservative witches. I don't know why that doesn't...
Well, these aren't witches.
Oh.
These are people practicing magic in a different form.
Mm-hmm.
But they think of magic as... Or they think of magical power as generated by a human battery, which has two opposite nodes, male and female. And you need those modes. And you need these implicit, subtle sexual attraction between them in order to generate the force. This view, I should say, is not shared by all magical practitioners, particularly by feminist witches in the States.
I read an interview recently with a magician. Now, that I realize that's something different, but he's a stage magician.
Yeah,
and he said, if I really had any of these powers, I wouldn't be bending spoons and levitating furniture. I'd be ending the homeless problem in this country. I would really be using those forces for something very good.
Well,
actually,
I have to tell you something, Lenny. I always said this. All the time, I would say these bizarre things about, well, come on, let's face it, how much power can these groups do? And I was really hostile and cynical about the harmonic convergence and thousands of people sitting around doing all these rituals. Although, if you looked at the news, a lot of amazing things have happened in the last year, and who knows?
Can we blame witches for those and not others? The harmonic convergence was a big joke. A lot of people
but
made
peace
fun
has
of it.
Broken out in a lot of places recently.
China, not.
Noel. Gorbachev. I mean, all kinds of stuff happened since
then. Well, but that's
there.
The way the world has always been. There have been
even
good
in the Sudan. I'm kidding. I'm not totally.
But what about using that kind of power for eliminating the major problems in our lives? In the end, what we're really talking about is people who are involving themselves in personal things mostly, isn't that
no,
true?
No, that's not
absolutely
true.
Not true.
It's people will range in the specific sort of instrumental goal that they have for their rituals. I mean, there are rituals for very specific purposes, like getting the house next door, although there are few enough of those. The very specific rituals tend to be directed towards healing people, often other people. There are many rituals with much larger goals. I've participated in rituals to combine pagan and Christian spiritual currents in England, to help the Contras,
help the Contras. There was a ritual to help the Contras in this country.
Conservative guys.
And see, in the United States, most of the rituals that I've participated in that have been very political have been very much on the left. I mean, there have been all kinds of affinity groups at Lawrence Livermore Lab and in the Clamshell Alliance and at Seabrook and all those kinds of places that have used rituals as a part of political demonstrations. And among feminist witches, there's been an enormous use of rituals as a way of bonding and increasing sort of political cohesiveness in groups.
Mm-hmm.
One other
Maybe
question.
Maybe we need a ritual to reconcile British and American Wicca.
Well, you know, the stuff that Tanya was talking about homosexuality is really interesting because in the United States, in the beginning, when Wicca came to the United States, there was a lot of homophobia. And that's because, again, the British based groups were based on male and female equal polarity. But then a lot of things hit. The feminist movement hit, gays who were active hit and started looking for a gay kind of spirituality, and suddenly all these witchcraft groups were confronted with certain political realities, and a lot has changed in the United States. So there is relatively little homophobia.
Do you pick the goddesses and gods that you include in your ritual based on your inclinations? Sexual and otherwise? Philosophical?
Absolutely.
Who
I think
are
that
the
this is,
major deities?
Well, the major deity is the goddess, and the goddess has many different forms. There's an idea that the goddess is all women and all experiences of womanhood. And there are different phases. There's the virgin huntress, the young goddess, the young
sort
of nubile.
Artemis, that kind of figure.
Yeah, the nubile female.
Diana,
mm-hmm. But that Diana is more associated with the with a mother, with a lover, with a sexual woman.
She was a huntress as well.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes. But I mean, the way in which the contemporary trough treats her, her sexuality tends to be sort of increased. There's also the hag, which is terribly important for people, particularly for women.
The cliche of the witch, the hag with the. You're talking about the hag?
That's right.
The crone. Yeah. The crone. And also think of it as the
pimples
phases
on the
of
nose
the moon.
And
well, think of the phases of the moon.
The
you have the waxing moon, the crescent, the young girl. You have the full moon, the mother, and you have the sort of waning moon as the old crone. And so it's all those different phases of womanhood. But I think we all pick goddesses from. I mean, I picked when I was 12. I decided the Greek goddesses were it. They were, you know, I didn't want to worship them. Let's be truthful. I wanted to be them. I mean, that's what was really going. On.
Hera and, Adler.
No. I was sort of Athena Adler, right? I even had diary entries about me taking on the role of Athena, which are very embarrassing to read, you know, in the mature, you know, over 40. But they were very powerful images. And growing up in the 50s, there weren't a lot of powerful images of women around me. And these goddess images were numinous. They were beautiful. They were romantic. They were the self I myself desired to be. And I think the thing that got me into Wicca more than anything else was that I came across a ritual and realized that there were rituals in which women took on the role of the goddess in ritual and became them in ritual. And they were not crazy. They were not considered, you know, 14-year-old crazies like me. They were adults.
But, Margot, this sounds more Jungian than Adlerian.
I think the therapeutic dimension is very powerful. And what people do is they choose goddess images or god images which speak to some part of themselves and either identify it and label it or enable them to reach out. I was particularly struck by a woman in London that I encountered, at Courtauld art student, who felt that she wasn't assertive enough. She had difficulty getting angry. She had difficulty sort of being present in a conversation. She tended to withdraw. And she, for about 2 years, focused on Sekhmet, an Egyptian goddess, a lion-headed goddess associated with fire. And she drew images, she drew pictures of Sekhmet, she wrote rituals about Sekhmet, she meditated on Sekhmet. And, I mean, this is only my personal impression, but my impression was that this enabled her to feel more comfortable being assertive and to take on the qualities of this goddess, which she was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. So you would really, it's like choosing a role model in a way. If there is somebody who is soft, then you might choose that one. And if there's somebody who's hard, you might choose that one depending on what you
want.
Well,
I'll give you an example from personal life.
Would it vary according to where you
want to go? Oh, absolutely. You could choose different goddesses for different times. For example, I had a salary negotiation recently. And
I'm curious to know which goddess you chose for this.
I chose Athena.
Oh, I thought there was going to be Susan Stamberg.
Anyway, I chose Athena, and I wrote, I was sitting there on the phone negotiating, and I just wrote the word Athena on my blotter over and over and over, and I was just saying, be that strong, be able to, because I'm one of these people who, you know, oh, well, I should pay you to work, right? One of these people who can never write. So I wrote the word Athena on my blotter, and I just thought and thought, and I was the first time in my life that I was able to really fight for what I wanted.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what's appealing to many people about a polytheistic religion is that you have many different images. So particularly for women, as they experience the cycles of their own growth and development, there are many different images to draw from and to identify with to help one cope with anger and rage, to help one cope with sort of self-possession and assertion, to help one cope with sort of the experience of childbirth, many different sorts of images which have the ability to label personal experience.
How do you deal with failure after you've done all the ritual and done it right, and you've gone in there for that salary negotiation, and you find out that you're not going to get the money you wanted? Then do you explain it off to something else? The Indians used to say that the ritual hadn't been performed correctly; otherwise, the magic would have had to have occurred.
Yes, the interesting thing is that failure is relatively uncommon, or the experience of failure is relatively uncommon. First of all, because you can attribute dramatic failure to the ritual itself. So it doesn't necessarily attack your theory or your set of ideas about magical efficacy. It tells you that you haven't done the ritual properly. You've used the wrong invocation or you've used the wrong format.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is that people see or understand magical power to work through the imagination. Because it works through the imagination, associated effects, which are somehow sort of imaginatively relevant, can be seen as a sign that the magical power was present. I mean, if you do a ritual to, say, get the house next door, and 3 weeks later a packet on sort of do-it-yourself building materials comes through the post, then that's passed off as a joke. I mean, look, I did this ritual, and mm-hmm. what a disaster it was. This is the way that it went wrong. And that combination enables people to argue, if they choose to, that the magical power is available.
Now, Margie, you said earlier that the ritual that you performed was simply to write Athena's name a lot and to focus on her and focus on the certain things that you were aiming for. Aren't there more complex rituals usually?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you? I know that this is what may reveal a lot, but since we have Starhawk publishing books that anybody can get out of the library, can we hear of a typical ritual that any of us might actually attempt, or would we have to do everything else? Would we have to know an awful lot before we could even pull off a ritual?
No, I mean, there are basic things that happen in most of the modern Wiccan rituals. Generally, even though there are different traditions and different deities and different words and so forth, generally the ritual takes place in a circle. And that circle is generally defined somehow. When you talked about the dark-handled knife or whatever, generally the only use of that knife is sort of to define sacred space. Mm-hmm. And basically,
not
we don't have a temple.
Not to perform sacrifices.
Exactly. So in other words, we don't have a temple. We don't have, very often this is in a living room or in a park. Mm-hmm. So basically, those tools are just props. They're not necessary. Basically, you want to say to your mind, this is a sacred place and a sacred time. So you do some things, right? You walk around in a circle, right? And then maybe you do something for the four elements. You know, you demark the quarters, because the elements in a lot of Western magical traditions have very specific ideas about qualities. For example, fire for passion and earth for groundedness and stability and air for thought in the mind and water for dreams and emotions and so forth. So you might have some kind of purification of the space according to the four elements. And if it's a seasonal ritual, you might have some kind of words about the season. You might have some kind of invocation for deities, god or goddess or whoever it might be. You might have a blessing of cakes and wine, for example. You might have something called the drawing down of the moon, in which the priestess in the group sort of speaks as the goddess and gives words or poetry to the group.
In a group. Now, does it matter whether you're doing this in a group?
No,
you
can do this.
You
can do this by yourself. You can do this by yourself. And so there are many things that might happen, but these are very typical things mm-hmm. that might happen a lot.
Well, what do people do in coven meetings? Sit around and compare rituals, or do they perform rituals?
In a coven meeting, or at least the coven meetings I attended, people would perform rituals, and you would arrive at a particular time on a particular Saturday night, and you would then go into the ritual chamber, a living room that had been transformed into a ritual chamber, very theatrically, very effectively, with candlelight and incense and an altar in the middle that looked sort of centuries old. And there were two sorts of rituals, either seasonal celebrations in which people were sort of symbolically acting out the turn of the seasons, or spells, which were attempts to help particular individuals. And those spells would involve people would try to shift their what you called state of awareness. And they would do so by, let's say, for example, one of the rituals I attended involved trying to get a coven member's relative a job. He lost his job. And he was in Austria, I think. And so we decided to do a spell for him. So she'd brought his picture, and she put it at the foot of the goddess after passing it around the group so everybody sort of knew what he looked like. And the idea was that somehow we were going to generate energy and then send it to him in a particular form. So she passed around the picture, we put it at the foot of the goddess, we held hands, and we began to sort of move in a sunwise direction, chanting this nonsense chant.
Mm-hmm.
And we chanted for about 5-10 minutes, increasing our speed until finally we were running at full speed. And we then stopped held up our hands, and we visualized this prearranged image, which I think was a tree rooted in the soil, somebody very settled, assured, self-possessed. And we imagined this tree, and we also thought of the woman who had presented his picture. And the idea was that we were, after generating this energy, we were directing it to this man using this woman as a channel.
And the group, the fact that there was more than one person there, actually gives it a bit more power?
There are many different theories about it.
Did he get the job?
He did get a job.
Of course, somebody will say, well, just like Margot. Margot is a great reporter. She would have gotten that money even if she hadn't written
Diana. I didn't get the money. Not yet.
Oh, well, you better get that money. Our guests have been Margot Adler, who is a regular on WNYC. You hear her on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. She's also a witch. And T.M. Tanya Lerman, who is an anthropologist and author of Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, Ritual Magic in Contemporary England. It's published by Harvard University Press. It's been a great pleasure having both of you on New York and Company.